When it comes to the lean executive recruiting landscape, staying ahead means staying informed. Subscribing to the Stiles Associates email list gives you access to the latest compensation data, industry analysis, and career resources straight from their recruiting team. Plus, you'll receive hand-picked career opportunities from leading companies, whether you're seeking new challenges or just curious about the market. So head over to leanexecs.com and sign up to get on the Stiles Associates email list and transform the way you make strategic decisions for your company and your career. Thanks for listening. Did you know I can help your organization on this journey of cultivating a culture of learning and innovation? I can be a trainer, coach, and advisor on topics including psychological safety, problem solving, and continuous improvement. I can add value to your management team meetings by speaking and facilitating discussions on these important topics. To learn more, visit markgraben.com or email me, mark@markgraben.com. Let's improve together.
Welcome to the Lean Blog Podcast. Visit our website at www.leanblog.org. Now, here's your host, Mark Graben.
Welcome to the podcast. This is episode 399 for February 3rd, 2021. For show notes, links, and more, you can go to leanblog.org/399. Please rate and review and subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already done so. And again, I want to thank our friends at Stiles Associates for sponsoring this episode. Thanks for listening. Well, hi, welcome to the podcast. I'm Mark Graben. We're joined today by Lisa Nichols. Lisa, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Mark.
Well, it's really good to have you here. In terms of background on Lisa, we're going to talk about her experience at Toyota. And I think we'll hear some of her career arc, you know, before Toyota and what she's been doing here after Toyota. Her website is lisanicholsconsulting.com, and that's Lisa with an E, L-E-S-A, Nichols, consulting.com. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. And Lisa also contributed, I stumbled over it before we started recording. She wrote a chapter. I didn't stumble intentionally that second time. Lisa wrote a chapter in our anthology book, Practicing Lean. And you can read that chapter for free on Lisa's website, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. So, Lisa, thank you for doing that chapter. It was nice of you.
Absolutely. That was fun.
And you've got a book that you're working on right now. I'm going to put you on the spot and ask about that.
Let's not. No. Yeah, I'm trying to. This all relates back to Mr. Oba, the book. Mm-hmm. So maybe if we could go through and share some of the stories about Mr. Oba, then I can tell you what I'm trying to do with it.
Okay, sure. Right. So yeah, today's episode with Lisa is in part an opportunity to reflect on Hajime Oba, who passed away in late 2020. And we've done a couple other episodes talking about him and his work and the lessons from him. So we'll get into that a little bit more, Lisa, and thank you for agreeing to talk about that and share about that. But I think it would be interesting for the audience to hear about your career and what led up to you going to work at Toyota. It was a little bit of a non-traditional path compared to, let's say, the stereotypical industrial engineering path that somebody like me might have taken, right?
Absolutely. Yes, very different path. So actually, I started in the political science universe. I'm curious since birth, I think. And so the political science route in college was very intriguing. You learn about history, put things in context. And so that was very interesting. On the side of that, I was also interested in criminal justice. So I got an opportunity to go to Washington to work for a U.S. senator. And I didn't have the luxury of being very specific about what I was going to be assisting with, but I was going to be working on legislative research and summarizing the different positions and the backgrounds and proposing positions for the senator. And when I got involved in that, I realized oh, I am so interested in everything. Mm-hmm. It's not just criminal justice. It's, you know, financial systems. It's all this. So I wound up talking to his chief of staff before I was going to come back from Washington. And I said, look, I'm all over the place here. I'm just fascinated with it all. And she said, well, if that's the case, I would recommend communications for you. And I was a little disappointed because I thought, oh, that's so general. You know, I'm not that doesn't really sound like it, but I respect this person quite a lot. So when I came back and I went to start a college again, and I took a couple courses in communications. And from then on, I was like, the political science aspect, if you can't communicate it about it, and then the organizational communication factors were just fascinating when I reflected back on working in the Senate. So I went that, studied communication and got a joint, you know, political science and communication degree. And then things started to really shift into an interesting universe for me. And that was, I went to intern for a public relations firm that in Kentucky that had been asked to help with community and labor relations for the building of the first Toyota wholly owned factory in the United States, which was in Georgetown, Kentucky. So they needed a young on the ground person who would do anything and everything to figure out the construction, how to communicate, and how to connect with the community. So that was fascinating. I love that. I love the watching a building, you know, just the whole watching the facilities emerge. And then Toyota said, we're going to come to Kentucky, but we're not going to have our staff yet. We're going to have a trailer, and that trailer is just going to have a few people in it. But we do need somebody to help handle public relations or communications things. So I was nominated for that. And that was just terrific because the people that were in that trailer were the ones that were going to be, they were the initial runners of the operations. And so from there, I just followed my curiosity into trying to understand anything and everything I could about Toyota, not so much about the culture, but about the technical infrastructure that I saw going up around me. Mm-hmm. And then listening to that was from the construction firm's viewpoint, but then started to listen to the Toyota people talk about how they were going to utilize this space. And accidentally, I will say, I mean, people say it's not, but I think it is. I wound up working with Mr. Cho, who was the president of that facility. And he needed to make speeches out in the community. And his English was not wonderful. And he had like amazing depth and experience to develop TPS in Japan, working with Mr. Ono. Mm-hmm. And I, as did everybody, I felt an instant connection with him. And I thought, if I can write anything for this man, I'm going to try my best to do it. So I became a speechwriter and did that for about 4 years, I guess. I had that as one of my many jobs, but it was probably my favorite. So I would, you know, work with him on, you know, what is it you want to try to communicate? How can I go to the shop floor to see that in life so that I can help explain, you know, what you want to communicate. Through that, he asked me on a couple of occasions, but I'd been to the floor and specifically I'd been out to look at the new the die construction capability and stamping.
Yeah.
And so he had mentioned that and somebody wanted to talk about that to an audience. And so I went to see it and I came back and I'm telling him all about it. I'm so excited. And he asked me, Lisa, what is it that you ultimately want to do? And I was like, I don't know. And he said, well, you love TPS, but are you going to become a technical scientist of TPS or a social scientist? And I was I don't know the difference. And he explained to me that the technical side is what we can feel and touch and look at, but the social science is more the how are we structuring to manage the people, and how are we as individuals behaving in the system? So I said, I think I want to be a social scientist because I would be more equipped for that. That's where I'm curious. He said, good, because you're starting to sound like a technical scientist. So let's just be clear about, you know, where you want to be.
Yeah.
And so then I started working a lot on some other kind of big issues with Toyota as they were growing in North America and becoming a full partner in the auto industry. There were a lot of issues around domestic content and not having happy relations with the supply base that was here and was being asked to supply Toyota in a way that seemed different than the traditional automotive industry. So I was in the middle of that, and out of that whole thing, Toyota realized that, you know, look, we're getting all this pressure from the United States to help them understand, like, are we doing business in the right way? And why is it so different? So Dr. Toyota and others, obviously, but they decided to create it's called Toyota Supplier Support Center, or TSSC. And its mission was to be, I saw it as kind of a technology transfer, a corporate contribution that would not be just writing a check. It would be setting up an organization that could help the supply base and help U.S. industry understand, take the mystery out of what TPS is, by providing resources who would be on the ground in the company's environments and help them implement it in their stamping or casting or whatever kind of processing beyond assembly that they had. So Toyota creates that. Mr. Obo was assigned. Mr. Cho was his, he was somebody that Mr. Obo really looked up to. So Mr. Obo was completely excited to be connected to this project. And he was named as the general manager to get it up and running. Mr. Cho became the chairman of TSSC. Right. And then we had a board of all the plants in North America, all their Japanese and Americans, vice president and president level, became the kind of founding advisor board. And Mr. Obo was at the helm. So I was hired to, there were three groups that he had designed, and I thought this was really interesting. It was called Toyota Supplier Support Center, but it was based off of the Operations Management Consulting Division in Japan. And Mr. Oba always was taking a unique tact on things. So he said, okay, we're going to have this technical group that will go out to plants and help them implement the production system, but I'm going to create this other group called research and training. And that's where I want Lisa and that team to come together. And then there was a third group that was administration and planning. And the research and training group, its responsibility was to connect with U.S. industry. You know, again, it's back to communication and curiosity. Understand who some potential partners are for us to. And Mr. Oba's thinking was, who can we learn from? So we said, okay, well, there's industry leaders out there. There's government. There are, we do want to hook up with some media people. And then the universities was a particular emphasis. Mr. Oba's thinking was that we only had so much expertise. And we're coming into America. We need to understand from people who are experts in America. And that the universities would, you know, give us some reflection of how we were doing.
Yeah.
So I ran that group with him for him, I'd say. And you had asked, I was thinking as we were talking earlier about how I met Mr. Oba. Mm-hmm. He actually was not involved in interviewing me. And so he hadn't met me. I guess he just heard about me. One week before I started this job at TSSC, I broke my foot, and I mean, broke it pretty impressively. So I came into the office for the first day on crutches. And so I remember Mr. Ova, I got to my desk and everything, sat down. He comes over and says, hello, how are you doing? And just really general, he goes away. And he watches me, I felt like, that whole day and for a few days that week. Because we had an open office, and to encourage communication and all that. But I felt like he is just watching me. What am I supposed to be doing other than learning this new job?
Yeah.
So towards the end of the day, maybe mid end of the week, he came over and he said, how about your foot? And I'm like, well, crutches, how long will this be? I said, not sure, maybe 4 to 6 weeks. And he said, you can't go to see anything for 4 to 6 weeks. Oh. And I said, well, I think no is not the right answer. The question is, how am I going to do that? So he said, well, you're interested to go. And I said, yes. And so he said, I'm going to send you with this one of our guys that worked hands-on on the floor. He said, I want to send you to this place in New Jersey. And I literally went on crutches with this guy in the middle of a snow and ice storm.
Oh.
And I mean, it was just crazy. But Mr. Ova, I have to say, I think that was probably the first test that I passed with him. I didn't let those crutches stop me. So that's my kind of, then I was at TSSC for, 6 years. And then I asked Mr. Ova, can I please have an opportunity to understand the reality behind these concepts? It seems so difficult to implement. And so I became production manager for Toyota. And then after that, went back to the Toyota headquarters and helped to set up the operations and management development division.
Yeah.
So very rambling career there.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I mean, maybe we can go back and unpack, some of the stories and experiences from the TSSC time, but, I'm really intrigued. I mean, maybe one way of expressing some of that is, if I can ask you about that transition, then to go into a production manager role. And can you help set context for people, at what level that was within or, in what department that was, and set some of that context. And then I'd be interested to hear, okay, now go from learning and teaching and helping others to now having production responsibility.
Yes. Okay. So at the time that I did that, Toyota had grown up quite a bit in the U.S. And so we had multiple manufacturing operations. We had already started to expand and put in powertrain organizations as well, which looking back on it now, I really see that as it's almost like being a supplier, really, to sure. Toyota. So Mr. Ova, when I asked him about the chance to rotate or have a position inside a Toyota plant, he said, well, you're at a manager level and that's really not heard of. You've got to grow up from the production floor or, you're going to have a really hard time and I don't think they would accept you. But let me think about it. And then he asked me, he did some investigation. He came back and he said, what kind of place do you want to be in? And I said, well, be good if I could go to assembly. And because I'm not an engineer and it would maybe be easier for me to manage. And he smiled at me and said, yeah, it also has a lot of people and you like people, right?
Yeah.
Like, right. He said, okay, I think powertrain is better for you. And to me, I gasping, seriously, could you find a more equipment intensive environment for me? Yeah. And he said, I think that's going to be the best place because you are a supplier to Toyota. And you're going to learn the real aspects of manufacturing aren't about people or machines. It's about people and machines.
Were you, so powertrain for people, listeners who aren't really auto, you know, don't know auto industry. I mean, I started my career General Motors powertrain, and I was in an engine plant.
Yes. Yeah.
So powertrain is engines and transmissions. And even within engine world. So like where I was, and I'm curious to hear a little more detail about where you were here when geek out on some of this for a minute. So I was working in a couple of areas that were suppliers to engine assembly. So we talk about machines and people. I was an industrial engineer for the engine block area department and connecting rods. And so then that fed into engine assembly, which then fed into two different General Motors assembly plants if we were doing well. And we were often not. But it was within that context that I had the good fortune to learn. My second plant manager there was one of the original General Motors New Me people. I don't know if you knew that, Lisa.
No, I didn't.
From our previous conversation. So that was my really kind of introduction to TPS, even though General Motors certainly didn't want to call it that. So I can picture, I think, the environment that you were in.
So we, in the facility that I was in, there was a four-cylinder engine and a V6 engine, and then we called it axle. It was all the, you know, transmission components. Mm-hmm. And in each of those shops, you know, the engine and the engine sides and the transmission, we had machining that created, you know, that took the rough material and basically machined it and polished it and got it in finished shape to send to the internal assembly lines. So in my case, we had we made steering arm knuckles and the shafts for the, you know, a lot of the wheel components. Those were machined, and then we would move those just in time to our assembly lines. And the assembly lines at that time had a tack time of, I think, or a, you know, we needed to meet a pace to supply the vehicle plants for Toyota. It was 27 seconds. And I had no idea. I mean, just no idea what just in time was until I went there, because literally you're making the whole axle, component, you know, the steering and brake mechanisms, you've got your spring and strut tower, and we would make those and put them in the pallets of, I think, maybe 40 per, and ship them over literally just in time to the vehicle plant. If anything happened on one of our assembly lines, if we had a machine down or some kind of material trouble, if it was down for more than 15 minutes, parts of the Toyota assembly line would come to a halt.
Wow.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I had a bit of that, you know, experience. I felt like the first year, that's all I did, but was learn how to manage major breakdowns. So that was the real world of just in time. I didn't really know that I was going to be learning all of that, but that's what Mr. Oba set me up for. It turned out that the guy who had followed in Mr. Cho's footsteps, Mr. Amazawa, he had worked under Mr. Ono, and he was the manager of the same shop that I was in Japan. And he was responsible for transforming it to TPS under Mr. Ono. Mm-hmm. So he became an amazing mentor to me, because there was no trouble that we had in my area that he didn't come to see and have some really unique, almost like camaraderie perspective on it. Mm-hmm.
Because he had kind of seen it before, probably.
Oh yeah, he'd seen it before, and he had.
But so in that coaching style then, and mentoring you, somebody who has seen it before, it seems like the approach at Toyota would be not to come in and tell you the answer. Oh, Lisa, I've seen this before. Here's what you need to do. It's a different approach, right?
No, he was great at asking me. These weren't Socratic method kinds of questions, you know. It wasn't like he was arrogant and had, you know, the exact answer I needed to discover. But there was one time when we were standing on the line, and I can only imagine what he was seeing, and I wasn't seeing it. Mm. And he said, so this is the type of screw gun you want on this assembly line. And I'm looking at it thinking, well, these guns have been here a lot longer than I have, and I don't really know the pros and cons of that. And he said, I don't really like those guns so much. I'm sitting here thinking, well, if you don't like them, why are they here? But okay. And I said, why don't you like them? And he said, well, if you notice, there's a, and we went over to the team member. He said, the team member can, you know, of course we want them to use the forward motion of the screw gun, but there's this button too, where they can back it out. And I was like, oh, wow. Okay. That sounds like that wouldn't be exactly great if we want, he said, why not? And so we're standing there. I said, well, if you can back out the screw, then you're covering up a problem and we're going to wind up with trouble that isn't going to show up on an and-on board. He said, exactly. But then it was like, obviously that was my trouble, you know, but then he's very, you know, says to me, how do you think something like this happened? Mm. You know, how could we have these type of guns that I don't like here and that you don't know anything about? I know you just got here, but, and I said, well, I'm going to learn all about the screw guns all over this place. I can tell you.
Yeah.
He said, well, anyway, so he just challenged me and said, well, I want to know what you learn and please come back to me and so that we can improve. Mm-hmm. And so we wound up doing a big, we call it Yoka 10, but looking across the whole powertrain facility to see how did these different types of guns and what's the best for a system that's supposed to believe in stopping exactly when we have trouble.
Yeah. One quick other tidbit, just comparing, the General Motors environment in the mid 90s to what you were experiencing, between powertrain and the assembly plant, their comfort level would have been a couple of days worth of inventory.
Wow. Yeah.
That was the goal. That was not always held to, hence some of the problems that led to us getting, a new plant manager. But, you know, it's this different mindset of like buffering to protect yourself from problems. Mm. Like, sure, on some level, they would have rather avoided the problems. But I think the GM leadership style of pressuring people and yelling and blaming and, you know, putting quantity over quality, ironically, ended up undercutting the ability to deliver to the plant. It was just a completely a different philosophy. And it was not doing well compared to our bunch benchmark plants that we looked at, whether it was Toyota or others.
Yep. Yeah. I could talk about the whole NUMMI thing for a while and how we translate the knowledge, you know, it's supposed to be a learning lab. And then the people who learn there come to other facilities, you know, back to GM facilities. But that's a pretty big order for people because you've only been living in the system that Toyota helped to set up. It's not the same as coming back to your home plant and implementing it from scratch. Big challenge for those people.
Yeah. And so my plant manager, Larry Spiegel, had been one of those original NUMMI General Motors people who was really successful. He was at a transmission plant and had done a successful turnaround. And so they brought him into a slightly bigger job, the Livonia engine plant. But for listeners who are interested in more of the NUMMI story, or Lisa, I'll point you to this. Back in 2016, I did a two-part interview with one of those original GM NUMMI people, Steve Barra.
Uh-huh. I know his name.
He was reflecting on that experience. And unlike Larry, who stuck with GM and retired from GM and then was teaching at the University of Michigan, Steve said, I can see no reasonable path forward of really transforming anything within General Motors. So I'm going to leave. Basically worked as a consultant. Because, you know, Steve was saying, like, the one story was, you know, that some of the original NUMMI people wanted to band together and go as a team to a facility back in General Motors and turn it around.
Yeah.
General Motors said, no, we're going to throw you one here, one there. And I think they, a lot of them looked and said, okay, I'm going to be a drop of water in the proverbial ocean. That's not going to work.
Yeah. I personally believe that. I mean, I just felt really bad for the people that I worked with when we supported NUMMI. You know, we would help them with Kaizen and everything. And I would interact a lot with plant managers who were going to be going back to a GM facility. And I thought, wow, this is so hard for them to come here and mm-hmm. learn this system, because they weren't exactly all on board from day one. They just wanted to say, this is my current thinking of how operations should be. And I see this and it looks different. And I'm not sure I accept this yet. And then over time they did or didn't accept it, but then they're tasked with going back and being that proverbial drop in the ocean. And it's just too much for it to expect, I think.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask a couple other questions of, you know, lessons that you had learned, from Mr. Oba, you know, from some notes, personal notes you had shared with me in advance. And I think it was number one on this list, as you put it, managers must fight to have floor time. And I'm curious, like, you know, if you could kind of elaborate on that thought, what creates that challenge? Why do managers really need to prioritize getting out to the floor?
Well, I don't know about, you know, other automakers, because Mr. Oba kind of specifically, I think, kept us away from mm-hmm. studying, you know, that part of the universe too deeply.
Sure.
I will say in Toyota's case, mm-hmm. At least in Georgetown when I was a production manager, the pressure that I felt was, okay, I knew conceptually that just-in-time balances quality, cost, and lead time. Safety is an assumed thing. But when I moved into that position, I inherited a schedule that was done by the previous production manager who had grown up from the floor. And that schedule was meeting after meeting after meeting to review, here are your safety results. Mm-hmm. And what are you doing about it? I mean, very deep into, I'd say, problem investigation. And so you go from a safety meeting to a quality meeting mm-hmm. to a productivity meeting. And I literally had the guy who was plant manager came to me at one point. He said, Lisa, why aren't you coming to the productivity meeting? And I said, I'm focusing on safety and quality. I can't focus on everything at one time. And he said, right, but the organization has to. Mm-hmm. So either it's you or it's somebody you designate. Mm. So I wound up finally, you know, figuring that out. It was pretty early on to how to distribute the people that supported, you know, my role. And then I found I got kind of good at that. And so I freed my time up to, let's say, go to the safety and quality meetings and skip the others. And so that gave me floor time. But what I realized is my peers that were managers, also a four cylinder and V6 engine, yep, they were still in those meetings. And, I felt bad for them, you know, because they didn't, I was in a unique spot, I guess, because everybody knew how much I wanted to learn. Yeah. But we would be in those meetings, they're deep problem solving. But if you're not on the floor, how in the world are you supposed to know enough to represent this analysis and the countermeasures? One thing that when Gary Combis came in, he listened to the managers. He had forums with us, and then he listened to what the barriers were for us to, you know, be doing some of the things we expect of Toyota types. And it was all these meetings, and he freed up. It was really wonderful. He said to every manager and above, between, I think it was one and two, it's a meeting free zone. Mm-hmm. Nobody can schedule any meetings. And that means whenever any of you see each other or I see you between those hours, you should be on the floor. Mm-hmm. So that's what I mean by having to fight to get there.
Yeah, so yeah, people might be surprised what you're describing of the, you know, the series of meetings, and yeah, that's a reality in many organizations. But yeah, going back to what you were talking about being a speechwriter, even then, because I'm like you had that curiosity and that drive to go out there. And,
yeah, that's the other thing. I think because the people, every manager in there besides me, had grown up from the floor. Not that they aren't curious people, but they've pretty much seen it all before.
Yeah.
So when they were speaking to a countermeasure or something, they knew what they were talking about. And for me, I'm going, I'm not going to explain us without knowing what we've done and what we're, you know, trying to improve for the future.
Yeah.
So I maybe fought for floor time more than others did.
So as a manager, you had, so there's the team members. And when you talk about people working their way up, people would often go from, like, you know, my friend David Meyer, who we've talked to on the podcast a couple of times, was a team member, became a team leader. And then I believe he reached, he was a group leader. And then you had group leaders reporting to you as a manager. Was that the
The structure Toyota, I don't know if they, you know, it's been a while since I've worked at Toyota, so I don't know if they still have this in place, but they created assistant manager roles to have the group leaders report to. And I know Mr. Ogle wasn't keen on that.
Why is that?
He felt, and I know, also in Japan, the manager role is revered. It's the connector between the shop floor and the upper management. So there's a strategy for the year, you know, a Hoshin strategy. That's not going to happen on the floor unless you've got a manager who can translate that and really connect with the people on the floor. So he felt like there's one more layer here of between a management person and the people who are doing the work. You know, we always all had the pressure of we don't add value. So, you know, as managers, unless we can develop people to be stronger problem solvers and we can solve the problems that they can't get to. So any kind of interruption in there was not encouraged by him.
Yeah. One other thing I want to follow up on, there was a phrase you used, you know, talking about priorities and what you focused on. You said safety is an assumed thing, but that doesn't mean safety was automatic because of this effort you're talking about. Can you elaborate on that idea of safety as assumed?
Well, that was probably one of my biggest learning points was before I went to the shop floor as a manager. That's what I heard from Mr. Oba and others. It's like, you know, we're talking about quality, cost, and lead time for just in time. And then, you know, people who were at TSSC would say, well, wait a second, you know, well, what about safety? And Mr. Oba and others would say, no, it's assumed that safety is there. And I think what he was saying is it's a prerequisite. Of course, it's safe. But when I got into operations, I realized the different levels of safety required. And while I was there, Toyota started looking very seriously at the ergonomics issues. This, I think, actually was probably in the first 6 months that I got there. In Japan, you know, we have an aging workforce. And then in the United States, we're trying to see how can we, you know, make these jobs as robust for people as possible. And so Toyota in Japan came up with a system to assess whether the job, the processes were, we called them green, yellow, or red. And then that would give you an instruction for your direction for what needs to be improved. And it took probably 9 months of my personal time focusing on nothing but ergonomics improvements with a team of, because our materials were just so fundamentally heavy in machining. I mean, when you pick the thing up, it's already, you know, so So I learned that, safety should be a precondition, but it's not without a lot of effort to maintain and improve.
Yeah. But imagine then coming back to a communication issue, the mantra that had been brought into General Motors and other automakers was safety, quality, delivery, cost. And that safety was articulated. There might be a risk of leaders thinking, well, of course, safety is a priority. Like I've seen at Toyota plants, whether it's San Antonio or in Japan, people enter the plant walking through the safety arch. And, there's a lot of, symbolism and, attention given to that. There might be a risk if it's not articulated, people somehow hear, well, they're not talking about safety. They only talk about quality, cost, and lead time. That would be a potential disconnect, right?
Right. So that was I still believe that I've become, and I'm not the only one, but I've become a hybrid. And that is the TPS strategist like Mr. Ova would speak that way. Of course, it's a prerequisite and we must focus on quality, cost, and lead time. Well, from an operations side, I don't remember anybody in a management position that didn't start with safety and quality.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Because what I came away with, Mark, is that it takes so much energy for people to get the product done safely with the quality that it stunned me, really. How much energy that takes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I spent my time on safety and quality, because as the lead time systems were already in place inside Toyota. I didn't have to worry about that so much other than problem solving. But the safety and quality aspects were fascinating for me. And it stuck with me. Like when I come into a plant that I'm looking at for the first time, I'm always looking first at safety and quality.
Right.
Because to me, the productivity comes later. If you are working with people to make sure their processes are safe and they can build quality, then if you're building a safe process and a quality process, it's going to be productive too.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there was alignment when you talk about Toyota wanting to learn from other companies. There was a partnership with Alcoa.
Right.
As one of those companies. Paul O'Neill, who was the CEO in the late 80s and through the 90s, who we also lost in 2020. Paul O'Neill already had that principle and that strong belief that nobody should be hurt at work, putting safety as a prevailing focus. I'm paraphrasing his what I've heard him say and talk about that. If you do all the things in an organization in leadership that are required to deliver your goal of perfect safety, then you will build what he called habitual excellence, and everything else will follow.
Yep.
You can be the best in the world at safety and at the same time aim to be the best in the world at everything else you do. So it seemed that the fact that that belief and philosophy was already there must have been the reason for that collaboration.
Yeah, Mr. Ova really connected with him because of that strong, not just philosophy, but he acted on it. One thing I would say about the safety aspect too, that I learned from Mr. Ova and others, but it's when we kind of TPS people or lean, I often find that we want to look for waste.
Mm-hmm.
And what I learned from Mr. Ova early on, thank goodness, is that no, we don't look for waste. We look for overburden.
Mm-hmm.
So in that overburden, the term in Japanese is muri. And it could be either physical overburden, which is going to get into the ergonomics and the acute potential. But the other is the mental overburden.
Right.
And those are so intertwined and hard to see. For me, they're not hard to see now. But if you can see, this is what Mr. Ova, I feel like he was a human systems engineer. Mm-hmm. He would look at the physical work and he would not come from the viewpoint of, oh, hey, how can we make this more productive? It's how can we eliminate that overburden mm-hmm. right there? Mm-hmm. And so the physical overburden was a lot easier to see. But I had 1 week with him where we just looked and only dealt with mental overburden for people. And that also had a huge impact on me because, you know, we don't speak about these things all the time. I mean, you get used to overburden and so you don't bring it up anymore.
Yeah.
But his teaching and my feeling and belief is that that's our responsibility to uncover and help.
That seems like a very direct, practical manifestation of respect for people or respect yes. for humanity. Not just talking about it, but
right.
driving priorities and actions. Then.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And he was just a genius at those kinds of things because we've been speaking a lot about the floor, but he's also a management development guru, I'd say, in that he didn't want to have special opportunities for people to learn. It was through the daily job. Mm-hmm. So we would have, you know, everybody has a staff meeting, right? Well, we would have a TSSC staff meeting and on Monday mornings. And that thing was not a staff meeting that I have been to since then. It was a learning meeting. And so like Mr. Ova would have somebody present, you know, we've got like 15 people around the table and different perspectives, different plants that they've worked in. And so we would have all been, let's say in the last month or so, working with tack time or make pacemakers. Mm-hmm. So Mr. Ova would have heard enough of that to realize that we didn't actually know why we were putting pacemakers in place. Mm-hmm. So we had, I remember one day I thought, wow, this is so intense. I can't imagine any other company doing this. We had a whole morning on the benefit of conveyors. And that was just the start. That became an ongoing theme that we came back to. What's the purpose of a conveyor? What's the basic logic behind automation? So we would go out every week and go to these different companies we were working with and see all these different situations. And he didn't feel good about launching us on the world if we didn't understand the basic thinking way behind what we were working with them to apply.
Yeah.
And I have to say that I don't work with people who do that kind of thing. And it's very liberating and motivating for people to be in that kind of management environment.
Yeah. Yeah. One other thing about the environment I wanted to ask, you know, one other thing that jumped out at me from going through your notes is the idea, as you had written down, learn from mistakes, willingness to share. Like this year I started a new podcast series called My Favorite Mistake, where we talk to people from all different walks of professional life who share willingly a story about a mistake and what they've learned from that. And a lot of times the conversation goes into, you know, how do we create that culture in a workplace? So what are some of your reflections around what you had taken down in your notes there? Learn from mistakes, willingness to share.
Yeah, that one is so deep. And I feel like I could do a companion, like a companion to your podcast. I could give you 20,000 things.
Maybe I can sign you up. I'll put you on. Well, we can talk later. Maybe yeah. You can come on My Favorite Mistake sometime. But
so Toyota sets up an environment where you are going to make mistakes. If there isn't buffer between the processes or there isn't much buffer there, we know things are going to mess up. And we want to do that because we want people to learn from the mistakes. But if we don't learn, then we keep making the same mistake and it's quite costly.
Right.
So we have to share. We have to learn and we have to share. And by sharing, you also learn more about what you really did. I'm just thinking about 100 examples, but we had a situation at a supplier that we worked with that was a kind of model plant for TSSC. And they had a TPS system in place that was really good, and we brought people there to take a look at it. And so I had been a production manager at Georgetown, and Mr. Ovo, but I'd come back to TSSC, and he said, I want you to go take a look at that plant and tell me what problems Toyota is causing for it. And so I came in and I looked at the regular, you know, their normal flow of processes, but I missed something very important that he knew about. And that was, and I shouldn't have, because I'd already been in production and I knew about this stuff, but I missed it. Somebody, because Toyota had increased the, they changed the mix of options for this company. So they, you know, it's no big deal for most of the assembly plant if somebody changes out the rubber stripping, you know, it's not that big of a deal. But for these people, they were making plastic air registers and cup holder components. And the color, just the color change that Toyota had introduced with the new model caused their volume to spike. I mean, it went, you wouldn't see it in the normal cells that I walked through, but they had, because the volume was so crazy from Toyota, they had set up this like offline center. I mean, it was just one person back there, but it was one person with the process set up, and that person was frantically working.
Yeah, there's that overburden.
No, it was overburden. And yes, and the overburden was caused by the, you know, we talk about fluctuation. You know, we want to try to get everything as even as possible. What I had observed when I went through was the evenness of the regular, you know, specs from Toyota. But because of just this one color change, we had made that crazy just spike for them. And it was terrible. So I, you know, obviously reported back to Mr. Oma and stayed there with that person to help Kaizen that process. And then my job then was to go back to Toyota plant and help them understand the burden that we'd put on them. So it was tough to, you know, admit to my boss after all this time that I still didn't know how to find an offline, you know, workaround. And then I got the pleasure of going back to my peers at the plants in Georgetown and helping them feel all warm and fuzzy about my experience. And then I had the chance to report it in our Monday morning staff meeting so that I could let all of the, you know, the people around me learn from my mistake. And it was at that point in reporting it out to the other guys that were there with me that I realized the value of it. I mean, it's tremendous, because if they can avoid missing that for themselves and they can see me as a bit of a humble leader, you know, a bit, and say, well, she was confident enough to go in there and report back to Mr. Ova, but she's got enough humility to come back here and tell us that she missed the big thing.
Right.
So it's creating technical learning, but then also hopefully some management development.
Yeah. And I did record an episode of my favorite mistake with Esao Yoshino, who had you know, almost 40-year career at General Motors. I'm going to hold up the book that Katie Anderson wrote sort of with him, about those lessons. And Mr. Yoshino tells a story of a mistake. You know, it fell in the category of human error. You mean to grab this and you grab that instead, and it caused a problem in the paint shop. And, you know, his leaders took responsibility for having not created a system that could have, let's say, you know, mistake-proofed that.
Right,
And, you know, he said that was a very important lesson to learn at a pretty young age in his career. So I'll put
and
a link.
That's why I stayed at that plant to, you know, because I knew it's leadership's responsibility. And if we, TSSC, have worked with that company to help them be a model, and my leadership didn't find that, then my leadership better be helping them overcome it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's completely expected. It's hard for people. We had, you know, managers who came to TSSC from outside companies, and they were not at all comfortable to be on the hook all the time for the learning mistakes that their people were, mm-hmm. were doing. It's like, well, wait a second, I just got here and it's not me. And that guy, you know, he doesn't have this degree or he didn't know that. And, you know, Mr. Oba and others just look at you and say, what is your point? You know, what are you going to do about this? How are you going to help them succeed? So it is a cultural shift, but lucky for me, I grew up in Toyota pretty much. Yeah. So
well, I think I cut you off.
Well, I got grounded in that early.
Yeah. Well, and that's where you think of those General Motors people who came into NUMMI. It was really difficult. They had to unlearn.
Yes, exactly.
Be willing to learn from Toyota. I was going to also add, you know, I think one other point of alignment philosophically with Alcoa and Paul O'Neill was that Paul O'Neill believed very strongly. I mean, he would say, for example, that, you know, to a plant manager, anything that happens in your factory is your responsibility. And right. Likewise, as CEO of the company, he didn't shirk that right. responsibility as well. And you might think, well, we've got, and I mean, I don't know what the employee count, I'm sure, surely it was tens of thousands, 100,000 employees. You think, well, how can I be responsible for every, you know, quote unquote, dumb decision that somebody might make? And like, well, that comes with the role of leadership, is that burden and that mm-hmm. responsibility.
What I liked about Toyota's approach in that kind of case, I would say, yes, I'm the CEO, but I'm only directly responsible for the decisions of these people around me. You know, it's a tiered approach. So it's that team member, team leader, group leader, so that everybody has a span of control mm-hmm. that's manageable-ish. Now, it is different at the CEO level, mm-hmm. But that same kind of, if you have a structure on the floor that is right sized to catch the problems as they happen, then it makes that pressure of the CEO a lot less mm-hmm. And a lot easier to manage, because when there is a failure, you know where to go.
One final question here before we wrap up, and thank you for introducing me, making the connection to Mr. Oba's, one of his sons, Hide Oba. It was great to do an episode with him and hear reflections on working with his father and learning from him. One thing he talked about was this idea of the soul of Toyota. And I know that was something that made you think. What was your reaction to that?
Well, it's a word that you don't hear often in manufacturing. And I noticed that when I was with Mr. Oba and Mr. Cho, they will use that word. And so it became a word that I used, not all the time, but, you know, purposefully to figure things out. And my take on it is that what they want to know is, and I was with Mr. Oba a million times when he would say to me, we'd been at a plant and we'd come through for the first pass assessment and any kind of company. And we would be with them, review the floor, talk about it with them. And then we'd come out and we'd drive back to where we were going. And he would say, I'm not so certain about their soul. And, you know, when I first started hearing, I thought that's a little deep. But what I ultimately realized is that Toyota's soul is around manufacturing. Toyota does all these other things wonderfully well, but in the end, they were born and grew from manufacturing. It's in their soul. Now, is the soul, you know, expanded as much as we want? Maybe not. But when we would go into a company, what Mr. Oval would think is their soul might be in marketing. They might be a design company. they wouldn't say that to you, of course. You know, they're like, we brought you here to look at manufacturing. But Mr. Oba's feeling was that if their soul isn't with manufacturing, if that's not their burning reason to get up in the morning, and that's not where they naturally want to go, then we might be pushing them to do something that they're fundamentally not aligned with.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I wound up having dinner with a guy, a CEO of a plant that I'd worked with for a while. And I was just on a, normally I'm pretty hands-on, but we were through that stage. And I said, I'm going to come back and check in with you. And he said, yeah, and we've got to go to dinner. I normally don't really do that. Got to go to dinner because I've got some kind of tough stuff to talk about. And he was just sharing, you know, he was a design guy originally. And he said, I know where you're trying to get me on this manufacturing thing. I know you're disappointed that I'm not moving as quickly or as purposefully there. And we went back and forth. He said, I just want to understand. And I said, well, I've just got a question. It was kind of heated. And I said, where is your soul? And he was like, and I said, no, I mean the soul of your company. I can't make it manufacturing. Right. If it's not manufacturing, that's fine. That's your company. But we need all of it. But I am going to have a really hard time helping you if your soul isn't oriented to the floor or to operations.
And that's just making me think, and maybe just leave it as a point of reflection. You know, there's a lot of people in the audience from healthcare. And if they're still listening, I think there's an interesting question to think about in healthcare. You know, is the soul of the organization the delivery of patient care?
Right.
And for the frontline staff, yes. But then as you get up through leadership ranks, is that the passion of the executives, or are they focused more on finance and other aspects of the organization?
Yeah, it is a deep question, but for me, it's really, because sometimes you'll have a disconnect, you know, maybe the organization in healthcare, the front line. I mean, most of those people are signing up because they do have a mission and purpose in life and a soul that is providing care. And then over time, as people, you know, get raised up to the executive ranks, maybe their personal objectives and focus start to disconnect with that front line, that front line view. I'm very lucky that our mutual friend Eric doesn't have that problem.
Right. Yes. Eric Dixon from UMass Memorial Health. Yes. And you think of, you know, staff and leaders at different levels. You can think of the effect of the accumulated overburden. For a lot of healthcare professionals, sadly, there is physical overburden, mental overburden. For leaders at different levels, they are facing mental overburden. And I think that was true before COVID.
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, it really, really is. It's huge.
Yeah.
But it you know, if we look at it from that view, then we've got a lot of possibilities and opportunities. If we just look at, okay, I know you guys are tired, but where's the waste? We got to get out of this. There's a different discussion. I know you guys are worn out mentally and physically. What can we do to make your lives better? Because if you're not here and not having enough energy to get through a day, then none of us are okay.
Yeah. Well, that's well said. And I'm very glad that you are helping Eric and working with him. And you know, I want to thank you, Lisa, as we wrap up here. Thank you so much for sharing your story and your reflections and your lessons from Mr. Oba and what you continue to do. So, you know, again, our guest has been Lisa Nichols. You can find her online, lisanicholsconsulting.com. I'll put links to all of that in the show notes. Lisa, I invite you to give the last word. Is there any other thought you might want to share before we go?
Not really. I'll say one thing. In Mr. Oba's case, he was, you know, I look back and he had an obituary that literally took me 1 minute to read. 1 minute. And I felt sad. But then I thought about, wow, what a network of enlightened, you know, people who are out there trying to do the right thing. that he's left, and his sons. It's just kind of joyous to see the people are that his legacy is living on. And so I know those of us that are really close to him are extremely motivated now to help keep the flame burning.
Well, and one illustration of that legacy and impact, I know I said I was giving you the final word, and you had a great final word there. You said you didn't, but you did. I think it's really inspiring. On the webpage with his obituary, the stories that people have posted as comments.
Yes.
About the impact that he had on them. That's really, really great to see.
Yeah.
I know he had a great impact on you, Lisa.
Yes. I was blessed. Absolutely.
So thank you for sharing some of that.
Thanks, Mark. It's been a lot of fun to talk to you as always.
It has been. Yeah. Great fun talking with you. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Lean Blog Podcast. For lean news and commentary updated daily, visit www.leanblog.org. If you have any questions or comments about this podcast, email Mark at leanpodcast@gmail.com.
Hey, podcast listeners, I'm excited to announce the release of the audiobook version of my new book, The Mistakes That Make Us, Cultivating a Culture of Learning and Innovation. Listen and dive into powerful insights on fostering growth through mistakes. Whether you're a leader, entrepreneur, or just trying to get better at learning from mistakes, this audiobook is for you. Get it now on Audible, Amazon, and Apple Books. Visit mistakesbook.com for more info.